home, Ari said. Only this time, there is going to be a war. He put his arm on the shoulder of his smaller friend. We are all damned proud of the work you have done in Karaolos with these refugees. I have done as well as can be expected, trying to train soldiers with broomsticks. Palestine is a million miles away to these people. They have no hope left. Ari, I don't want you antagonizing Mandre anymore. He's a wonderful friend.
I can't stand people patronizing us, David.
And we can't do the job here without him and the Greek people.
Don't be fooled by the Mandreas all over the world. They weep crocodile tears and they pay lip service to our millions of slaughtered. But when the final battle comes, we will stand alone. Mandria will sell us out like all the others. We will be betrayed and double-crossed, as it has always been. We have no friends except our own people. Remember that.
And you are wrong, David snapped back.
David, David, David. I have been with the Mossad and the Palmach for more years than I care to remember. You are young yet. This is your first big assignment. Don't let emotion cloud your logic.
I want emotion to cloud my logic, David answered. I burn inside every time I see something like that convoy. Our people locked up in cages like animals.
We try all sorts of schemes, Ari said. We must keep a clear head. Sometimes we are successful, sometimes we fail. Work with a clear mind, always. Even now they could still hear the sound of sirens over the breeze. The young man from Jerusalem lit a cigarette and stood for a moment in thought.
I must never stop believing, he said solemnly, that I am carrying on a new chapter of a story started 4,000 years ago.
He spun around and looked up at the big man excitedly.
Look, Ari, take the place you landed tonight. Once the city of Salamis stood there. It was in Salamis that the Bar Kokhba revolution began in the first century. He drove the Romans from our country and reestablished the kingdom of Judah. There's a bridge near the detention camps. They call it the Jews' Bridge. It has been called that for 2,000 years. I can't forget these things. Right in the same place we fought the Roman Empire, we now fight the British Empire 2,000 years later.
Ari Ben-Kanan stood a head taller than David Ben-Ami. He smiled down at the younger man as a father might smile at an over-enthusiastic son.
Finish the story. After the Bar Kokhba revolution, the legions of Rome returned and massacred our people in city after city. In the final battle at Baitar, the blood of murdered women and children made a crimson river which flowed for a full mile. Akiva, one of the leaders, was skinned alive, and Bar Kokhba was carried off to Rome in chains to die in the lion's den. Or was it Bar Giora who died in the lion's den in another revolution? I can get these revolutions mixed up. Oh yes, the Bible and our history are filled with wonderful tales and convenient miracles. But this is real today. We have no Joshua to make the sun stand still or the walls to come tumbling down. The British tanks will not get stuck in the mud like Canaanite chariots, and the sea has not closed in on the British navy as it did on Pharaoh's army. The age of miracles is gone, David.
It is not gone. Our very existence is a miracle. We outlived the Romans and the Greeks and even Hitler. We have outlived every oppressor, and we will outlive the British Empire. That is a miracle, Ari.
Well, David, one thing I can say about the Jews. They certainly know how to argue. Let's get some sleep.
Chapter 7
Your move, sir,
Fred Caldwell repeated.
Yes, yes. Forgive me.
Brigadier Sutherland studied the chessboard and moved his pawn forward. Caldwell brought out a knight, and Sutherland countered with his own.
Dash it,
the brigadier mumbled as his pipe went out. He relit it. The two men glanced up as they heard the dim but steady, shrill screams of sirens. Sutherland looked at the wall clock. That would be the refugees from the illegal ship Door of Hope.
Door of Hope, Gates of Zion, Promised Land, Star of David,
Caldwell said with a snicker. I will say one thing. They do give those blockade runners colorful names.
Sutherland's brow furrowed. He tried to study out his next move on the board, but the sirens would not leave his ears. He stared at the ivory chessmen, but he was visualizing the convoy of lorries packed with agonized faces, machine guns, armored cars.
If you don't mind, Caldwell, I think I'll turn in.
Anything wrong, sir?
No. Good night.
The brigadier walked from the room quickly and closed the door of his bedroom and loosened his smoking jacket. The sirens seemed to screech unbearably loudly. He slammed the window shut to drown the noise, but still he could hear it. Bruce Sutherland stood before the mirror and wondered what was going wrong with him. Sutherland from Sutherland Heights. Another distinguished career in a line of distinguished careers that went on, the same as England itself. But these past weeks on Cyprus, something was happening. Something tearing him to pieces. He stood there before the mirror and looked into his own watery eyes and wondered where it had all begun. Sutherland, good fellow to have on your team, said the yearbook at Eton. Right sort of chap, that Sutherland. Proper family, proper schooling, proper career. The army? Good choice, Bruce, old man. We Sutherlands have served in the army for centuries. Proper marriage. Nettie Ashton, the daughter of Colonel Ashton, was a clever catch. Fine stock, Nettie Ashton. Fine hostess, that woman. She always has the ear of the right person. She'll be a big help to your career. Splendid match. The Ashtons and the Sutherlands. Where the failure? Sutherland wondered. Nettie had given him two lovely children. Albert was a real Sutherland, a captain in his father's old regiment already, and Martha had made herself a splendid marriage. Bruce Sutherland opened the closet and put on his pajamas. He touched the roll of fat about his waist. Not too bad for a man of 55. He still had plenty of punch left. Sutherland had come up fast in World War II by comparison to the slow, tedious advancements in the peacetime service. There had been India, Hong Kong, Singapore, and the Middle East. But it took a war to show what he was made of. He proved to be an exceptional infantry commander. V.E. Day found him a brigadier. He put on his bedroom slippers and sank slowly into a deep chair and dimmed the lamp, and he was filled with remembering. Nettie had always been a good wife. She was a good mother, a tremendous hostess, and a woman cut out for colonial service in the army. He had been very fortunate. When had the break come between them? Yes, he remembered. It was in Singapore so many years ago. He was a major when he met Marina, the olive-skinned Eurasian woman. Marina. Born and made for love. Each man has a Marina hidden deep in his inner thoughts, but he had his in the flesh, and she was real. Laughter and fire and tears and passion. Being with Marina was like being in a bubbling volcano ready to erupt. He was insane for her. He desired her wildly, madly. He threw jealous tantrums before her, only to half-sob, begging forgiveness. Marina, Marina, Marina. The black eyes and the raven hair. She could torment him. She could delight him. She could spiral him to heights he never knew existed on this earth. Those precious, magnificent moments of their trysts. His hands had clutched her hair and pulled her head back, and he had looked at her deep red, sensuous lips. I love you, you bitch. I love you.
I love you, Bruce,
Marina had whispered. Bruce Sutherland remembered the stunned, hurt look on Nettie's face as she confronted him with evidence of his affair.
I won't say this hasn't hurt me deeply, Nettie said, too proud for tears. But I am willing to forgive and forget. There are the children to think of. There is your career,
and our families. I'll try to make a go of it with you, Bruce. But you must swear you'll never see that woman again, and that you'll put in an immediate request for transfer from Singapore.
That woman. That woman, you call her, Bruce thought, is my love. She has given me something that you or a thousand Nettys never could or never will. She has given me something no man has a right to expect on this earth.
I want your answer now, Bruce.
Answer? What could the answer be? A man can have a woman like Marina for a night, for a touch, but she is not real. There is only one Marina to a man, one to a lifetime. Answer? Throw away his career for a Eurasian girl? Bring scandal on the name of Sutherland? I will never see her again, Neddy, Bruce Sutherland promised. Bruce Sutherland never saw her again, but he never stopped thinking of her. Perhaps that is where it all started. The sounds of the sirens were very faint now. The convoy must be quite near Carolus, Sutherland thought. Soon the sirens would stop and he could sleep. He began thinking of the retirement that would be coming in another 4 or 5 years. The family house at Sutherland Heights would be far too big. A cottage, perhaps, in the country. Soon it would be time to think about a pair of good hunting setters and gathering rose catalogs and building up his library. Time to start thinking about a decent club to join in London. Albert, Martha, and his grandchildren would indeed be a comfort in retirement. Perhaps he would take a mistress, too. It seemed strange that after nearly 30 years of marriage, he would be going into retirement without Nettie. She had been so quiet, reserved, and distinguished all those years. She had been so sporting about his affair with Marina. Suddenly, after a lifetime of complete propriety, Nettie burst out frantically to salvage her few years left as a woman. She ran off to Paris with a bohemian chap 10 years her junior. Everyone sympathized with Bruce, but it really didn't matter to him much. There had been no contact and little feeling for Nettie for many years. She could have her fling. They were quite civilized about it. Perhaps he would take her back later. Perhaps a mistress would be better. At last, the sirens from the convoy stopped. There was complete silence in the room except for the muffled shushing of the surf breaking on the shore. Bruce Sutherland opened the window and breathed in the cool, crisp November air. He went to the bathroom and washed and placed the bridge of 4 teeth in a glass of solution. Damned shame, he thought, losing those 4 teeth. He had said the same thing for 30 years. It was the result of a rugby game. He examined the other teeth to satisfy himself they were still in good shape. He opened the medicine chest and studied the row of bottles. He took down a tin of sleeping powders and mixed a double dose. It was difficult to sleep these days. His heart began racing as he drank down the solution. He knew it was going to be another one of those horrible nights. He tried desperately to lock out or stifle the thoughts creeping into his brain. He covered himself in bed and hoped sleep would come quickly. But it was already beginning to whirl around and around and around in his mind. Bergen-Belsen. 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 Nuremberg. 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 Nuremberg! Take the stand and give your name. Bruce Sutherland, Brigadier General, commander of... Describe in your own words. My troops entered Bergen-Belsen at 5:20 in the evening of April 15th. Describe in your own words. Camp number one was an enclosure of 400 yards wide by a mile long. That area held 80,000 people.
mostly Hungarian and Polish Jews. Describe in your own words. The ration for Camp Number 1 was 10,000 loaves of bread a week. Identify, yes, those are testicle crushers and thumbscrews used in torture. Describe, our census showed 30,000 dead in Camp Number 1, including nearly 15,000 corpses just littered around. There were 28,000 women and 12,000 men still alive. Describe! We made desperate efforts, but the survivors were so emasculated and diseased that 13,000 more died within a few days after our arrival. Describe! Conditions were so wretched when we entered the camp that the living were eating the flesh of the corpses. The moment Bruce Sutherland had completed his testimony at the Nuremberg war crimes trials, he received an urgent message to return to London at once. The message came from an old and dear friend in the War Office, General Sir Clarence Tever Brown. Sutherland sensed it was something out of the ordinary. He flew to London the next day and reported at once to that huge, ungainly monstrosity of a building on the corner of Whitehall and Great Scotland Yard, which housed the British War Office.
"Bruce, Bruce, Bruce. Come in, man. Good to see you. I followed your testimony at the Nuremberg trials. Nasty bit of business."
"I am glad it is over," Sutherland said.
"Sorry to hear about you and Neddy. If there is anything at all I can do..."
Sutherland shook his head. At last, Tever Brown led up to the reason for asking him to come to London.
"Bruce," he said, "I called you here because a rather delicate assignment has come up. I must give a recommendation, and I want to put your name up. I wanted to talk it over with you first."
"Go on, Sir Clarence."
"Bruce, these Jews escaping from Europe have posed quite a problem. They are simply flooding Palestine. Frankly, the Arabs are getting quite upset about the numbers getting into the Mandate. We here have decided to set up detention camps on Cyprus to contain these people, at least as a temporary measure until Whitehall decides what we are going to do with the Palestine Mandate."
"I see," Sutherland said softly. Tever Brown continued.
"This entire thing is touchy and must be handled with great tact. Now, no one wants to ride herd on a bunch of downtrodden refugees, and the fact is, well, they have a great deal of sympathy on their side in high quarters, especially in France and America. Things must be kept very quiet on Cyprus. We want nothing to happen to create unfavorable opinion."
Sutherland walked to the window and looked out the Thames River and watched the big double-deck buses drive over the Waterloo Bridge.
"I think the whole idea is wretched," he said. "It is not for you and me to decide, Bruce. Whitehall gives the orders. We merely carry them out."
Sutherland continued looking out of the window. "I saw those people at Bergen-Belsen. Must be the same ones who are trying to get into Palestine now." He returned to his chair. "We have broken one promise after another to those people in Palestine for 30 years.
"See here, Bruce," Tever Brown said. "You and I see eye to eye on this. But we are in a minority. We both served together in the Middle East. Let me tell you something, man. I sat here at this desk during the war as one report after another of Arab sellouts came in. The Egyptian chief of staff selling secrets to the Germans. Cairo all decked out to welcome Rommel as their liberator. The Iraqis going to the Germans. The Syrians going to the Germans. The Mufti of Jerusalem, a Nazi agent. I could go on for hours. You must look at Whitehall's side of this, Bruce. We can't risk losing our prestige and our hold on the entire Middle East over a few thousand Jews."
Sutherland sighed. "And this is our most tragic mistake of all, Sir Clarence. We are going to lose the Middle East despite it."
"You are all wound up, Bruce."
"There is a right and a wrong, you know." General Sir Clarence Tever Brown smiled slightly and shook his head sadly.
"I have learned very little in my years, Bruce. But one thing I have learned. Foreign policies of this or any other country are not based on right and wrong. right and wrong? It is not for you and me to argue the right or the wrong of this question. The only kingdom that runs on righteousness is the kingdom of heaven. The kingdoms of the earth run on oil. The Arabs have oil.
Bruce Sutherland was silent. Then he nodded.
Only the kingdom of heaven runs on righteousness, he repeated. The kingdoms of the earth run on oil. You have learned something, Sir Clarence. It seems that all of life itself is wrapped up in those lines. All of us, people, nations, live by need and not by truth.
Tever Brown leaned forward.
Somewhere in God's scheme of things, he gave us the burden of an empire to rule.
Ours not to reason why, Sutherland whispered. But I can't seem to forget the Arab slave markets in Saudi Arabia, and the first time I was invited to watch a man have his hands amputated as punishment for stealing. And somehow I can't forget those Jews at Bergen-Belsen.
It is not too good to be a soldier and have a conscience. I won't force you to take this post on Cyprus.
I'll go. Of course I'll go. But tell me, why did you choose me?
Most of our chaps are pro-Arab for no other reason than our tradition has been pro-Arab, and soldiers are not in a position to do much other than follow policy. I don't want to send someone to Cyprus who will antagonize these refugees. It is a problem that calls for understanding and compassion.
Sutherland arose.
I sometimes think, he said, that it is almost as much a curse being born an Englishman as it is being born a Jew.
Sutherland accepted the assignment on Cyprus, but his heart was filled with fear. He wondered if Tever Brown had known he was half-Jewish.
That decision, that horrible decision he had made so long ago, was coming back to haunt him now.
He remembered that afterward he began to find solace in the Bible. There were those empty years with Nettie, the painful loss of the Eurasian girl he loved, and it all seemed to plunge him deeper and deeper into a longing to find peace of mind. How wonderful for a soldier like him to read of the great campaigns of Joshua and Gideon and Joab. And those magnificent women, Ruth and Esther and Sarah, and Deborah. Deborah, the Joan of Arc, the liberator of her people. He remembered the chill as he read the words, "Awake. Awake, Deborah. Awake. Awake. Deborah." That was his mother's name. Deborah Davis was a rare and beautiful woman. It was small wonder that Harold Sutherland was smitten with her. The Sutherland family was tolerant when Harold sat through 15 performances of The Taming of the Shrew to watch the beautiful actress Deborah Davis, and they smiled benevolently as he went over his allowance on flowers and gifts. It was a boyish fling, they thought, and he'd get over it. Harold could not get over Deborah Davis, and the family stopped being tolerant. She defied an edict they issued for her to appear at Sutherland Heights. It was then that Harold's father, Sir Edgar, traveled to London to see this amazing young woman who refused to travel to Sutherland Heights. Deborah was as clever and witty as she was beautiful. She dazzled Sir Edgar and completely won him. Sir Edgar decided then and there that his son had been damned lucky. After all, the Sutherlands were known to have a tradition of inclining toward actresses, and some of them had become the grandest dames in the family's long history. There was, of course, a touchy business of Deborah Davis being a Jewess, but the matter was closed when she agreed to take instructions in the Church of England. Harold and Deborah had 3 children. There was Mary, their only girl, and there was moody, irresponsible Adam, and there was Bruce. Bruce was the oldest and Deborah's favorite. The boy adored his mother. but as close as they were, she never spoke of her own childhood or of her parents. He knew only that she had been very poor and run away to the stage. The years passed. Bruce took up his army career and married Nettie Ashton. The children, Albert and Martha, came. Harold Sutherland died, and Deborah moved along in age. Bruce remembered so well the day that it happened. He was coming to Sutherland Heights for a long visit and bringing Nettie and the children. Deborah would always be in the Rose Garden or the conservatory, or floating about gaily on her duties, smiling, happy, gracious. But this day, as he drove up to Sutherland Heights, she was not there to greet him, nor was she anywhere about to be found. At last he discovered her sitting in darkness in her drawing room. This was so unlike Mother that it startled him. She was sitting like a statue, looking at the wall, oblivious to her surroundings. Bruce kissed her on the cheek softly and knelt beside her. "Is something wrong, Mother?" She turned slowly and whispered, "Today is Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement." Her words chilled Bruce to the bone. Bruce talked it over with Nettie and his sister Mary. They decided that since Father had died, she had been alone too much. Furthermore, Sutherland Heights was too big for her. She should move into an apartment in London where she could be closer to Mary. Then, too, Deborah was getting old. It was hard for them to realize, because she seemed to them as beautiful as when they were children. Bruce and Nettie went off for his tour of service in the Middle East. Mary wrote happy letters that Mother was getting along fine, and the letters from Deborah told of her happiness to be in London near Mary's family. But when Bruce returned to England, it was a different story. Mary was beside herself. Mother was 70 years old now and acting more and more strangely, a creeping on of senility. She could not remember something that had happened a day ago, but she would utter disconnected things about events that took place 50 years ago. It was frightening to Mary because Deborah had never spoken of her past to her children. Mary was most alarmed of her mother's strange disappearances. Mary was glad that Bruce had returned. He was the oldest and Mother's favorite, and he was so steady. Bruce followed his mother one day on one of her mysterious walks. It led to a synagogue in Whitechapel. He thought it all over carefully and decided to leave her alone. She was old. He did not feel it proper to confront her with things that had happened over 50 years before. It was best to let it pass quietly. At the age of 75, Deborah Sutherland lay on her deathbed. Bruce got back to England just in time. The old woman smiled as she saw her son sitting on the edge of the bed. "You are a lieutenant colonel now. You look fine. Bruce, my son, I haven't too many hours left."
"Hush now, Mother. You'll be up and about in no time."
"No, I must tell you something. I wanted to be your father's wife so badly. I wanted so much, so very, very much, to be the mistress of Sutherland Heights. I did a terrible thing, Bruce. I denied my people. I denied them in life. I want to be with them now. Bruce, promise that I shall be buried near my father and my mother."
"I promise, Mother."
"My father, your grandfather, you never knew him. When I was a little girl, he would hold me on his lap and he would say to me, 'Awake, awake, Deborah, awake, awake.'"
Those were the last words Deborah Sutherland spoke. Bruce Sutherland sat in numb grief for a long hour beside the lifeless body of his mother. Then the numbness began to thaw under the nagging burn of a doubt that would not be kept out of his mind. Must he be bound by a promise he had made a dying woman? A promise he was forced to make? Would it be breaking the code of honor by which she had always lived? Wasn't it true that Deborah Sutherland's mind had been going on her bit by bit over the past years? She had never been a Jewess in life. Why should she be one in death? Deborah had been a Sutherland and nothing else. What a terrible scandal would be created if he were to bury her in a shabby, run-down Jewish cemetery on the poverty side of London. Mother was dead. The living, Nettie, Albert, and Martha, and Mary's family and Adam, would be hurt deeply. The living had to be served. As he kissed his mother farewell and walked from her room, he had made his decision. Deborah was put to rest in the family vault at Sutherland Heights. The sirens from the convoy of refugees. The sirens shrieked louder and louder and louder until they tore through his eardrums. Bergen-Belsen, Marina, Nettie, caged trucks, the camps at Carolos. I promise, Mother. A burst of thunder rocked the house to its very foundation, and the sea outside became wild, and waves smashed up the shore and raced nearly to the house. Sutherland threw off the covers and staggered about the room as though drunk. He froze at the window. Lightning, thunder, the raging water grew higher and higher. God, 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 God!
Brigadier Sutherland! Brigadier Sutherland! Wake up, sir! Wake up, sir!
The Greek houseboy shook him hard. Sutherland's eyes opened, and he looked about wildly. The sweat poured from his body, and his heart pounded painfully. He gasped for breath. The houseboy quickly brought him a brandy. He looked outside to the sea. The night was calm, and the water was as smooth as glass, and lapped gently against the shore.
"I'll be all right," he said. "I'll be all right."
"Are you sure, sir?"
"Yes."
The door closed. Bruce Sutherland slumped into a chair and buried his face in his hands and wept and whispered over and over, "My mother in heaven. My mother in heaven." Chapter 8. Brigadier Bruce Sutherland slept the sleep of the tormented and the damned. Mandria, the Cypriot, twisted and turned in a nervous but exhilarated sleep. Mark Parker slept the sleep of a man who had accomplished a mission. Kitty Fremont slept with a peace of mind she had not known in years. David Ben-Ami slept only after reading Jordana's letter so many times he knew it by memory. Ari Ben-Kanan did not sleep. There would be other times for that luxury, but not now. There was much to learn, and little time to learn it in. All during the night he pored over maps and documents and papers, absorbing every fact about Cyprus, the British operation, and his own people there. He waded through the stacks of data with a cigarette or a coffee cup continuously at hand. There was a calm ease, a sureness about him. The British had said many times that the Palestinian Jews were a match for anyone on matters of intelligence. The Jews had the advantage that every Jew in every country in the world was a potential source of information and protection for a Mossad Aliyah Bet agent. At daybreak, Ari awakened David, and after a quick breakfast, they rode in one of Mandria's taxis out to the detention camp at Karaolos. The compounds themselves stretched for many miles in an area that hugged the bay, midway between Famagusta and the ruins of Salamis. The garbage dumps were a contact point between the refugees and the Cypriots. The British guarded them loosely because the garbage detail was made up of trustees. The garbage dumps became trading centers where leather goods and artwork made in the camp were exchanged for bread and clothing. David led Ari through the dumps where the early morning bartering between Greeks and Jews was already going on. From here, they entered their first compound. Ari stood and looked at the mile after mile of barbed wire. Although it was November, it was chokingly hot under a constant swirl of blowing dust. Compound after compound of tents were stretched along the bay, all set in an area of low-hanging acacia trees. Each compound was closed in by 10 to 12 foot walls of barbed wire. On the corners there were searchlight towers manned by British guards armed with machine guns. A skinny dog began following them. The word Bevin was painted on the dog's sides, a bow to the British Foreign Minister. It was the same scene in each compound they visited, packed with miserable and angry people. Almost everyone was dressed in crudely sewn purple shorts and shirts made from cloth that had been torn from the inner linings of the tents. Ari studied the faces filled with suspicion, hatred, defeat. In each new compound, Ari would suddenly be embraced by a boy or girl in the late teens or early 20s who had been smuggled in by the Palestine Palmach to work with the refugees. They would throw their arms about him and begin to ask questions about home. Each time, Ari begged off, promising to hold a Palmach meeting for the whole group in a few days. Each Palmach head showed Ari around the particular compound he or she was in charge of, and occasionally Ari would ask a question. For the most part, he was very quiet. His eyes were searching the miles of barbed wire for some key that would help him get 300 people out. Many of the compounds were grouped together by nationalities. There were compounds of Poles and of French and of Czechs. There were compounds of Orthodox Jews, and there were compounds of those who banded together with similar political beliefs. Most compounds, however, were merely survivals of the war, with no identity other than that they were Jews who wanted to go to Palestine. They all had a similarity in their uniform misery. David led Ari to a wooden bridge that connected two main portions of the camp by crossing over the top of the barbed wire walls. There was a sign on the bridge that read, "Welcome to Bergen-Belsen."
"It is rather bitter irony, Ari, this bridge. There was one exactly like it in the Lodz ghetto in Poland."
By now David was seething. He berated the British for the subhuman conditions of the camp, for the fact that German prisoners of war on Cyprus had a greater degree of freedom, for the lack of food and medical care, and just for the general gross injustice. Ari was not listening to David's ranting. He was too intent on studying the structure and arrangement of the place. He asked David to show him the tunnels. Ari was led to a compound of Orthodox Jews close to the bay. There was a row of outside toilets near the barbed wire wall. On the first toilet shack was a sign that read, "Bevingrad." Ari was shown that the fifth and sixth toilets in the line of sheds were fakes. The holes under the seats led under the barbed wire and through tunnels to the bay. Ari shook his head. It was all right for a few people at a time, but not suited for a mass escape. Several hours had passed. They had nearly completed the inspection. Ari had hardly spoken a word for 2 hours. At last, bursting with anxiety, David asked,
"Well, what do you think?"
"I think," Ari answered, "that Bevin isn't very popular around here. What else is there to see?"
"I saved the children's compound for last. We have Palmach headquarters there."
As they entered the children's compound, Ari was once again pounced upon by a Palmachnik. But this time he returned the embrace with vigor and a smile on his face. For it was an old and dear friend, Yoav Yarkoni. He whirled Yarkoni around, set him down, and hugged him again. Yoav Yarkoni was a dark-skinned Moroccan Jew who had emigrated to Palestine as a youngster. His black eyes sparkled, and a huge brush of a mustache seemed to take up half of his face. Yoav and Ari had shared many adventures together, for although Yoav was still in his early 20s, he was one of the crack agents in the Mossad Aliyah Bet, with an intimate knowledge of the Arab countries. From the beginning, Yarkoni had been one of the wiliest and most daring operators in Mossad. His greatest feat was one which started the Jews of Palestine in the date palm industry. The Iraqi Arabs guarded their date palms jealously, but Jarkoni had managed to smuggle 100 saplings into Palestine from Iraq. David Ben-Ami had given Yoav Jarkoni command of the children's compound, for it was, indeed, the most important place in the Karaolos camp. Yoav showed Ari around the compound, which was filled with orphans from infancy to 17 years of age. Most of them had been inmates of concentration camps during the war, and many of them had never known a life outside of barbed wire. Unlike the other compounds, the children's section had several permanent structures erected. There was a school, a dining hall, a hospital, smaller units, and a large playground. There was a great deal of activity here in contrast to the lethargy in the other areas. Nurses, doctors, teachers, and welfare people from the outside, sponsored by money from American Jews, worked in the compound. Because of the flow of outsiders, the children's compound was the most loosely guarded in Karaolos. David and Yoav were quick to capitalize on this fact by establishing Palmach headquarters in the compound. At night, the playground was transformed into a military training camp for refugees. The classrooms were turned from standard schools into indoctrination centers in Arab psychology, Palestine geography, tactics, weapons identification, and 100 other phases of warfare instruction. Each refugee receiving military training by the Palmach had to stand trial by a kangaroo court. The pretense was that the refugee had got to Palestine and had been picked up by the British. The Palmach instructor would then put him through an interrogation to try to establish that the refugee was not in the country legally. The refugee had to answer 1,000 questions about the geography and history of Palestine to prove he had been there many years. When a candidate successfully completed the course, the Palmach arranged an escape, generally through the children's compound or the tunnels, to the White House on the hill at Salamis, whence he would be smuggled into Palestine. Several hundred refugees had been sent to Palestine that way, in groups of twos and threes. British CID was not unaware of the fact that irregular things took place inside the children's compound. Time and again they planted spies among the outside teachers and welfare workers. But the ghetto and the concentration camps had bred a tight-lipped generation of children, and the intruders were always discovered within a day or two. Ari ended the inspection of the children's compound in the schoolhouse. One of the schoolrooms was, in fact, Palmach headquarters. Inside the teacher's desk was a secret radio and transmitter which maintained contact with Palestine. Under the floorboards, weapons were hidden for the military training courses. In this room, papers and passes were forged. Ari looked over the forgery plant and shook his head. "This counterfeit work is terrible," he said. "Yoav, you are very sloppy." Jarkoni merely shrugged. "In the next few weeks," Ari continued, "we are going to need an expert. David, you said there is one right here?"
"That's right. He is a Polish boy named Dov Lando, but he refuses to work."
"We have tried for weeks," Yoav added.
"Let me speak to him."
Ari told the two men to wait outside as he stepped into Dov Landau's tent. He looked over at a blond boy, undersized and tense and suspicious at the sudden intrusion. Ari knew the look, the eyes filled with hate. He studied the turned-down mouth and the snarling lips of the youngster, the expression of viciousness that stamped so many of the concentration camp people.
"Your name is Dov Landau," Ari said, looking directly into his eyes. "You are 17 years old and Polish. You have a concentration camp background, and you are an expert forger, counterfeiter, and duplicator.
My name is Ari Ben Kanan. I'm a Palestinian from Mossad Aliyah Bet."
The boy spat on the ground.
"Look, Dov, I'm not going to plead, and I'm not going to threaten. I've got a plain out-and-out business proposition. Let's call it a mutual assistance pact." Dov Landau snarled.
"I want to tell you something, Mr. Ben Kanan. You guys aren't any better than the Germans or the British. The only reason you want us over there so bad is to save your necks from the Arabs. Let me tell you, I'm getting to Palestine all right, and when I do, I'm joining an outfit that's going to let me kill."
Ari did not change expression at the outburst of venom that erupted from the boy.
Good. We understand each other perfectly. You don't like my motives for wanting you in Palestine, and I don't like yours for wanting to get there. We do agree on one thing. You belong in Palestine, and not here.
The boy's eyes narrowed with suspicion. This Ben Canaan was not like the others.
Let's take it a step further, Ari said. You're not going to get to Palestine by sitting here on your arse and doing nothing. You help me, and I'll help you. What happens after you get there is your business.
Dov Landau blinked with surprise.
Here's the point, Ari said. I need forged papers. I need piles of them in the next few weeks, and these boys here can't forge their own names. I want you to work for me.
The boy had been thrown completely off guard by Ari's rapid and direct tactics. He wanted time to look for a hidden trick.
I'll think it over, he said.
Sure, think it over. You've got 30 seconds.
And what will you do if I refuse? You going to try to beat it out of me?
Dov, I said we need each other. Let me make myself clear. If you don't go along with this, I'm going to personally see to it that you're the last person out of the Karaolos detention camp. With 35,000 people ahead of you, you'll be too old and feeble to lift one of those bombs by the time you get to Palestine. Your 30 seconds are up.
How do I know I can trust you?
Because I said you could.
A faint smile crossed the boy's face, and he nodded that he would go to work.
All right. You get your orders from either David Ben-Ami or Yoav Yarkoni. I don't want you giving anyone a bad time. If you have any problems, you ask for me. I want you to report to Palmach headquarters in a half hour and look over their plant, and let David know what special materials you'll need.
Ari turned and walked out of the tent to where David and Yoav waited.
You'll report the work in a half hour, Ari said.
David gaped, and Yoav's mouth fell open in awe.
How did you do it?
Child psychology. I'm going back to Famagusta, Ari said. I want to see you two boys at Mandria's house tonight. Bring Zev Gilboa with you. Don't bother to show me out. I know the way.
David and Yoav stared in fascination as their friend, the remarkable Ari Ben Canaan, crossed the playground in the direction of the garbage dumps. That night, in his living room, Mandria, the Cypriot, waited, along with David, Yoav, and a newcomer, Zev Gilboa, for the appearance of Ari Ben Canaan. Zev Gilboa, also a Palestinian Palmachnik, was a broad-backed farmer from the Galilee. Like Yarkoni, he too wore a large, brush-like mustache and was in his early 20s. Zev Gilboa was the best of the soldiers among the Palmach Palestinians working inside Karaolos. David had given Zev the task of heading military training for the refugees. With zest, with improvised weapons, and by using the children's playground at night, he had taught his trainees nearly everything that could be taught without actual arms. Broomsticks were rifles, rocks were grenades, bed springs were bayonets. He set up courses in hand-to-hand fighting and stick fighting. Mostly, he instilled tremendous spirit into the spiritless refugees. The hour grew very late. Mandria began pacing nervously.
All I know, he said. I gave him a taxi and a driver this afternoon.
Relax, Mr. Mandria, David said.
Ari may not be back for 3 days.
He has strange ways of working. We are used to it.
Midnight passed, and the four men began to sprawl out and make themselves comfortable. In a half hour, they began to doze, and in an hour, they were all asleep. At 5 o'clock in the morning, Ari Ben Canaan entered the room. His eyes were bleary from a night of traveling around the island. He had slept only in brief naps since he had landed on Cyprus. He and Zev Gilboa hugged each other in the traditional Palmach manner. Then he set right to work without offering excuse or apology for being 8 hours late.
Mr. Mandria, have you got us our boat yet?
Mandria was aghast. He slapped his forehead in amazement.
Mr. Ben Canaan, You landed on Cyprus less than 30 hours ago and asked me for a boat. I'm not a shipbuilder, sir. My company, Cyprus Mediterranean Shipping, has offices in Famagusta, Larnaca, Carinia, Limassol, and Paphos. There are no other ports in Cyprus. All my offices are looking for a boat for you. If there is a boat on Cyprus, you will know it, sir.
Ari ignored Mandria's sarcasm and turned to the others.
Zev, I suppose David has told you what we're going to do?
The Galilee farmer nodded.
From now on, you three boys are working for me. Find replacements for your jobs at Karaolos. Yoav, how many healthy children are there in that compound between the ages of 10 and 17?
Oh, probably around 600 or 700.
Zev, pick out 300 of the strongest. Get them in the peak of physical condition.
Zev nodded. Ari arose.
It will be light in another half hour.
I'll need a taxi to start out again, Mr. Mandria. I think that man I had yesterday is a little tired.
I will drive you around myself,
Mandria said.
Good. We'll leave just as soon as it turns light.
Excuse me. I want to look over some papers in my room.
He left as suddenly as he had entered. Everyone began talking at once.
Then the escape is going to be made by 300 children?
Zev said.
It certainly appears so, Mandria said. He is such a strange man. He expects miracles. He doesn't tell anything.
On the contrary, David said, he does not believe in miracles. That is why he works so hard. It seems to me that there is more to this than Ari is telling us. I have a feeling that the escape of 300 children is only part of what is in his mind.
Yoav Yakoni smiled.
We have all known Ari Ben Kanan long enough not to try to second-guess him. We also have known him long enough to know that he knows his business. We will learn in due time just what Ari is up to.
The next day, Mandria drove Ari around Cyprus in what seemed to be an aimless chase. They drove from the sweeping eastern bay, past Salamis and Famagusta, clear to Cape Greco. In Famagusta, he walked along the old wall and studied the harbor area. Ari barely spoke to Mandria the entire day, except to ask a pertinent question now and then. It seemed to the Cypriot that the big Palestinian was the coldest human being he had ever met. He felt a certain hostility, but he could not help admiring Ari for his absolute concentration and seemingly superhuman stamina. He must, Mandria thought, be a tremendously dedicated man. But that was puzzling because Ben Kanan seemed to show no traces of human emotion. From Cape Greco, they drove along the southern bay on the underbelly of Cyprus and then into the high jagged mountains where the resorts prepared for the winter season of skiing and ice sports. If Ben Kanan had found anything of interest, he certainly was not showing it. Mandria was exhausted when they arrived back in Famagusta after midnight, but there was another meeting held with Zev, David, and Yoav. Then Ari went into another all-night session of study. On the morning of the fourth day after Ari Ben Kanan had swum ashore onto Cyprus, Mandria received a call from his Larnaca office to the effect that a ship had just come in from Turkey that fitted his specifications and could be purchased. Mandria drove Ari to Karaolos to pick up David and Yoav, and the four of them drove off for Larnaca. Zev Gilboa was left behind, as he was already at work selecting the 300 children and setting up special training courses for them. Mandria was feeling quite proud of himself as they drove along the Famagusta-Larnaca road. At a halfway point, Ari was suddenly attracted by some activity taking place in a large field off to the left of the road. He asked Mandria to stop the car and stepped outside for a look. There was feverish building going on in what appeared to be a military barracks.
The British are building new detention compounds, David said. They've reached the saturation point at Karaolos.
Why wasn't I told about this? Ari snapped.
You didn't ask, Yoav Yarkoni answered.
The best we can figure, David said, is that they'll begin transferring the overload from Karaolos in 2 or 3 weeks.
Ari returned to the car, and they drove on. Yoav Yarkoni, who declined to try to second-guess his friend, could nevertheless see that Ari was definitely intrigued by the new compounds. Yoav could almost hear the wheels grinding in Ari's brain. The car entered the narrow bending streets of Larnaca and moved on to the waterfront road, lined with its neat two-storied white houses. They stopped before the Four Lanterns Tavern, where the Turkish owner of the ship, a man named Armatal, awaited them. Ari insisted they forego the round of drinks, the fencing for price, and general bartering that was so much a part of the normal business transactions. He wanted to see the ship immediately. Armatal led them over the street to the long pier that jutted more than a half mile into the water. As they walked past a dozen or more trawlers, launches, and sailboats, Armatal kept up a constant stream of talk over his shoulder. He assured them that the ship they were about to inspect was indeed a queen of the sea. They came to a halt near the end of the pier before an ancient wooden-hulled salvage tug that bore the faded name on her bow, Aphrodite.
"Isn't she a beauty?"
Armatal said, glowing. Then he held his breath apprehensively as four pairs of cold eyes surveyed the old scow from stem to stern.
"Of course," the Turk continued. "She's no racing cruiser."
Ari's practiced eye estimated the Aphrodite at 150 feet in length and displacing around 200 tons. By her general build and appearance, she was in the neighborhood of 45 years of age.
"Now, just who was Aphrodite?"
Yoavyarkoni asked.
"Aphrodite was the goddess of love.
She was washed up in the surf just a few miles from here, 5,000 years ago," David answered.
"Well, this old girl has sure had her change of life,"
Yoav said. The Turk swallowed and tried to smile at the jibes. Ben Canaan spun around and faced him.
"Armatal, I'm interested in one thing. It's 200 miles to Palestine. She's got to make one run. Yes or no?"
Armatal threw up both arms.
"On my mother's honor," he said, "I have made 300 runs between Cyprus and Turkey. Mr. Mandria owns the shipping company. He knows."
"It is true," Mandria said. "She is old, but reliable."
"Mr. Armatal, take my two friends aboard and show them the engines." When the other three had gone below decks, Mandria turned to Ari.
"Armatal may be a Turk, but he can be trusted."
"What kind of speed can we get out of this thing?" Ari asked.
"Probably 5 knots with a gale in her back. The Aphrodite is in no hurry."
They went on deck and looked over the topside. She was half rotted away and long past the time it would have paid to repair her. Yet, despite the obvious qualifications, there was something very sound about her, a solid feeling that she knew the tricks of the sea and had won many battles against it. In a half hour, David and Yoav completed their inspection.
"This ship is an absolute abortion," David said, "but I am positive she'll make it."
"Can we get 300 aboard?"
Ari asked. David rubbed his jaw.
"Well, maybe, with a shoehorn."
Ari turned to Mandria.
"We will have a lot of refitting to do. Of course, it is necessary that we don't attract any attention."
Mandria smiled. He was in his glory now.
"I have, as you may well know, very good connections. It is merely a matter of greasing the right palms, and you can be sure that nothing can be seen, heard, or reported."
"David, send a radio message to Palestine tonight. Tell them we need a captain and a 2-man crew.
"Is a crew of 3 going to be enough?"
"I might as well tell you. You 2 boys and Zev are coming back to Palestine with me on this mud scow. We'll fill out the crew. Yoav, you've always had a tendency toward mature women. Well, you've got one now. You're in charge of getting this thing refitted and stocked up."
At last he turned to Armatal, who was still bewildered by Ari's rapid-fire questions and commands.
"Okay, Armatal, you can breathe easy. You've sold us this monstrosity, but not at your price. Let's go into the 4 lanterns and lock this up."
Ari jumped off the deck onto the pier and gave Mandria a hand.
"David, you and Yoav find your own way back to Famagusta. Mr. Mandria is driving me to Kyrenia after we finish our business."
"Kyrenia?"
Mandria said, startled.
"Doesn't that man ever get tired? Kyrenia is on the other side of the island,"
he protested.
"Is something wrong with your automobile?"
Ari asked.
"No, no. We shall drive for Kyrenia."
Ari started off down the pier with Mandria and the Turk.
"Ari," David called, "what shall we name the old woman?"
"You're the poet," Ari called back. "You name her."
Yoav and David watched the three men disappear at the end of the pier. Suddenly they broke out in smiles and threw their arms about each other.
That son of a gun, Ari.
He picks a fine way to tell us we're going home.
You know, Ari, the scorner of sentiment and emotion, David said.
They sighed happily, and for a moment both thought about Palestine. Then they looked about the Aphrodite. She certainly was a sorry old girl. They walked around the deck, examining the ancient hulk.
I've got a good name for her, Yoav said. Why don't we call her the Bevin?
I've got a better name, David Ben-Ami said. From now on, she will be known as the Exodus.
Chapter 9 Mark pulled the rented car off the road and parked it. He had driven high up in the mountains, directly over Kyrenia. An enormous, jagged rock, several hundred feet high, rose to a peak before them. On the peak were the ruins of St. Hilarion Castle. It was a fairy castle, suggesting, even in semi-collapse, the might and splendor of Gothic power. Mark took Kitty's hand and led her over the field toward the peak, and they climbed the battlements until they stood on the lower wall and looked into the castle yards. They picked their way through royal apartments and great halls and stables and the monastery and fortifications. It was deathly silent, but the grounds seemed to be alive and breathing, with ghosts of the past whispering of another day filled with love and hate and war and intrigue. For almost an hour, Mark and Kitty climbed slowly up the peak toward the summit. Then at last they stood on the very top, perspiring and breathless, dazzled at the breathtaking panorama below them. Below was a sheer cliff that fell nearly 3,000 feet to Kyrenia. On the horizon they saw the coastline of Turkey, and to the left and right the lush green forests and terraced vineyards and houses.